Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 25th, 2022, and welcome to episode 260 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and preparation and procrastination. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, and soon another who is coming late. But first we have Quinn Dunkey in the wilderness of British Columbia. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. It's fall here, which is my favorite time of year, so very much enjoying the weather outside.
Excellent. And also we have Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's also very nice here. The leaves haven't started to turn yet. It seems like they're a little late this year. And I was mentioning before we got started with the show, it's going to be 88 degrees, so summer is hanging on for just a little bit longer in Portland. You can probably see I've got all the nice natural light that's backing me up here.
That's amazing, yeah. It's the weather turned cold pretty abruptly for us here, but anyway, yeah, so it goes. All right, so, oh, and we expect that Blake will join us a little later. He's en route, so we will later hear from him and how his weather is. So, but okay, so this is episode 260. We've been proceeding through these episodes, at least in this little set, where we try to like talk a little bit about things that had happened in the year that's kind of related to the last two digits. So 1960 is this episode's year. And I've discovered actually through this that people are not super precise about what year things happened.
Yep.
So, for example, we talked about COBOL last time. But people sometimes talk about COBOL as being a 1960 thing, and Earl is here this time, so we may get back to COBOL. There are a couple different things that that we could talk about, but anyone have anything they want to start with? Maybe we could start even with COBOL.
So, did either of you have to take any COBOL courses in university?
No, I did not actually. I've never actually written a line of COBOL in my life. I've seen some in source code, but I've never written it or had to really learn it.
Well, it was pretty fascinating. I did have to take a course in COBOL. It was one of the first computer science courses I took, heaven help me. And it was interesting because unlike most of the other courses, about half the class dropped within the first 3 to 4 weeks. So
more computer time for you.
Exactly. It was really the great, you know, gauntlet that you had to walk through. And everybody talks about it being super verbose, which it was. I'd done, a fair amount of programming in BASIC up to that point and had done some Fortran. And when I saw COBOL, I couldn't believe just the sheer amount of words that you had to use. And I was used to, with Fortran, having to have some pretty precise formatting rules, which you do in COBOL as well. So that didn't throw me. But yeah, the verbosity of the language was something to behold. Hello World is, you know, like a mile long. But I think it's fascinating you probably talked about this in the last episode. I wasn't on the last episode, right?
Right.
Right. Not. Yeah, I wasn't there. So
we talked a bunch of nonsense largely.
Well, yeah, we noted your absence as the only person who knows anything about COBOL, and we were all talking about it.
I mean, did you talk about the fact of its staying power? Because it has just hung around for so long, and now they're actually trying to find younger people to get interested in COBOL so that they can maintain the millions or billions or whatever it is, of, you know, lines of source code that are still out there for COBOL. And that's something that I think would be a very fascinating computer history topic to research. Like, why did that hang on for so long? Was it that it was used in business and that business just has a bunch of institutional inertia built in? Mm-hmm. Or is it because there's something about the language that, I don't know, the numerical precision or the structure, the data structures, or, you know, why? I don't know that answer. But did you guys talk about that at all? Because it is fascinating to me.
We didn't talk about that specific angle, which is actually, that's an interesting one. I think you're probably right with the first thing, that it's just institutional inertia. You know, the types of businesses that used COBOL were banks and financial institutions and aerospace companies, and those are not companies that like change or that move quickly. So I would guess that it was just a case of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know, for 40 years kind of thing. And I think once that stuff gets entrenched, probably fixing it is enormously expensive. You know, you're probably looking at rewriting systems in, you know, like in the banking industry, for instance, you're probably talking about these systems spanning multiple countries and thousands of offices and who knows, ATM machines or who knows what. So it's probably, to go in and rip all that out and redo it is probably very, very expensive and complex. And so every time someone thinks about, hey, maybe we should redo this, so it just never hits that tipping point of being worth doing, probably. That'd be my guess anyway.
Yeah.
Hey, there's Blake.
Blake has joined us. Hello, Blake.
Hello, coming a little bit late. Sorry, folks.
That's good to see Blake you. Patterson from Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks. It's been a while. I've had a series of many weeks of crazy, bizarre occurrences, including brushes with rabies and kitchen remodels and long work hours. And it's good to be back. Glad to join, if a bit belatedly.
Excellent. So I think our viewers are going to need to know, do you or do you not have rabies?
No. There was a squirrel attack, and doctors were involved.
I've seen those. It's not pretty.
Yeah, you know.
Adorably terrifying.
Yeah, so it wasn't, we determined everything was fine. But yeah, you know, a couple of hospital visits and just to, you know, ER to get assessments and, yeah, so, you know, good times. But I think more, half of it, I think, that we're actually going through at my work, we're going through a it's always the most fun thing, a front end or back end, I guess I'm more full stack, but a developer can do is the entire site redesign. So this is the third one in my career, and so it's taking I think for the next 9 months I'll be in a very busy mode. Unfortunately I've not been able to join as frequently as I would like, but hopefully I can make that better. But yes, so good to be here. It sounds like COBOL is being discussed.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it sounds, you know, we were just talking about like institutions and getting over the sort of like threshold of needing of redesigning everything. It sounds like that's kind of what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, not to, you know, my work is not retro, but I work for a university and we are doing a full site redesign right now. I'm the only front end developer. I'm really a full stack developer. Most of my career was back end, but I'm the front end guy. And you know, we're trying to hire an additional, we've lost a number of people because of, I think, opportunities during the you know, shutdown. And but sadly, I'll say that as soon as we finish the redesign, we are going to switch to a as yet undetermined entirely new CMS, which will have a different backend language. And so that'll require actually reprogramming all of the 280 or so custom modules in a language that has yet to be determined. So it'll be interesting.
One vote for COBOL.
Yes, we could do the I should write a COBOL content management system. The I mean, some are written in, I guess they call it WebAssembly, which sounds horrifying, but...
It is. I've touched WebAssembly a little bit, and it is horrifying.
I've never touched it. I don't... I feel like computers... I'd rather throw money at a faster computer than have to get into WebAssembly, I guess, if that's the thought for performance. But or maybe it's just like a masochistic sort of endeavor. I don't know. But yes, so we'll see. With COBOL, I guess I have just a tiny tidbit since I'm joining and interrupting the flow. I'll just say it's my I guess the post I held the longest. I was almost 10 years working for the AFL-CIO as a developer, and there was one COBOL developer there, and he was a rather older gentleman. There was not going to be another COBOL developer after he retired, but I remember when I first met him and went into his office, saw the COBOL books on the shelf. And so that was interesting to see. There had been mainframes there in some years, maybe a decade before I got there. And and there were still some COBOL systems being run on Suns that were doing certain mathematical things. But I think they all got translated or just lost relevance, the tools that were being run. So. I touched on COBOL in college. I had one of my classes, and you know, computer science classes, was like a survey of like 6-7 different languages. I think it was COBOL, Ada, Lisp, and you know, Snowball was one, and there were a few.
Everybody's favorite.
Yeah, COBOL was interesting. I think COBOL, if I recall, like the indentation. Matters in the code, like as far, unless I'm confusing that with something else. So that was my only COBOL experience. But yes, I actually worked at a place where COBOL was being used, and but I didn't ever touch it. So COBOL, 1960.
Yeah, I've never programmed on it. It's and you know, so I've occasionally like skimmed over listings or whatever. But it's interesting this. Verbosity, like that's somehow that didn't register with me. Mm. And it does seem like it's a little surprising that a language that is so old, that was put on machines that are so limited, that there would be this space wasted with being verbose.
An interesting thought.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think, wasn't it one of its original design goals was to be more human readable, right? Like that was that was a big catch phrase or idea for so many years that, oh, we can make a programming language that's just like reading English. And every time they try it, they tried it again with AppleScript and, you know, various other things. And it never works, but people keep trying it every 20 years or so.
Hmm. And, I mean, you can read them, you know, writing them is a whole separate story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does read easier. But yeah, writing it just ends up being a game of guess the preposition.
Right.
I think Brandon kind of nailed it in the comments. He said that, I've heard that the staying power and the pain of rewriting is more to do with the whole IBM mainframe environment, like the CICS. And I think actually, you know, mainframes haven't like just stood on their laurels. They have kept up with technology, gotten faster and faster and faster, and you've got this bulk of code. It's already qualified. Through years and years of hard work, you know it does what it's advertised to do. And you can build interfaces to it. I knew a couple of people that I knew, friends of mine, whose job it was to interface with this code, like to build a layer of abstraction to it so that you could talk to it with, I guess, more modern type of systems. And it would just chug away, and you could chug through the millions of transactions per second or whatever. So it did the job. So I guess that was maybe one of the upsides of it, is that it just worked. So
yeah, that's a really good point, that we used to say that software has a wisdom built into it. The older it is, the more likely it is that all the kinks have been worked out. So if a piece of code is doing something really critical, like financial transactions at a bank, you're going to be very, very hesitant to touch that, because as we all know, you know, from fault analysis 101 in software, that if you touch a line of code, you're going to create two or three bugs. Like it's going to happen. And then you're going to have to spend a few more months removing those bugs, and they may be hard to find. And you may not know they're there for a while, and such a bug could do a lot of damage before you find it. So if something is as critical as financial transactions, then yeah, that would contribute a lot to inertia, because no one is going to be want to be the one to touch that code, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't touch it if it works. It's like, yeah, I'll write an API for it, but I'm not going to touch it.
One of the things I think we were thinking about last time when we talked about this was the idea that even if somebody isn't trained in COBOL, like even if people aren't taking COBOL programming, the people who would maintain future COBOL might be the people who are just sort of good programmers and can pick up a language. But that also is, you know, the verbosity of COBOL also sort of fights against that too, because I sort of feel like I can, you know, because I know, you know, Ruby, I can kind of remember, I can figure out what Python's going to do. You know, like I know that there's got to be a way to do this thing, and I just have to look it up. Whereas with COBOL, it might not work quite that way. You might not be able to predict the kinds of things you would expect to find without really just sitting down and studying it.
Yeah, that's true. I think, yeah, I had made the point in the last time we talked about it that programming languages all kind of have the same paradigms, the same data structures and so on. So you're really just learning the syntax in this particular language for what's a list and what's a hash table or whatever. But when you get back to those older languages like COBOL, that starts to fall apart, because a lot of them did not use the same concepts and paradigms that we use today. A lot of them had very different kind of mindsets for the data structures and core concepts that were in them. So yeah, that would be interesting to see how easy it really would be for someone like us to learn COBOL now and go back and try to apply your Python knowledge or your C++ knowledge, and does it really help or not?
Especially you look at what they were attempting, you know, which is to make it, you know, easily readable. I mean, I think their goals were, you know, as machine independent and as easily readable as possible, but they were attempting this as far as the readability so early, you know, in the era of programming that, you know, I think if they, I guess you say AppleScript is another take on it. You know, I haven't compared the two as far as readability. You know, being a developer that writes a lot of code in more traditional languages, you know, PHP, Perl, actually ColdFusion at the office these days. But like I find it difficult. I find it, you know, awkward and cumbersome, you know, languages that are trying to be easy, you know, because I'm a programmer. But that's sort of not the point. I guess they were, you know, going for what they were, you know, non-developers. I don't know where they pictured it going, but it's just interesting to think of how early they were attempting that. So
I think the people I don't know how do you write HyperCard stacks? I mean, like, is that AppleScript at all? So it is, right?
It's HyperScript, which was a predecessor of AppleScript. But okay. 90% of it, though, you can do in the GUI, but then you can also, like, open up a button to write some code to as well if you want.
Because I know I've heard, you know, a couple of times people saying that, like, that was the thing that made it easy enough for them to do, you know, that they could learn how to program because it was close enough to how their brain thought about what they wanted this button to do.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite languages, and it's in the same family, obviously, is AppleScript, HyperScript, is NewtonScript. When I would do programming on the Newton, I mean, it was more friendly as far as its syntax, you know, more English-like, not so much as AppleScript, I guess, but just the way things worked, and there were certain GUI-tied elements. It was just a really, really nice. I didn't do a great deal of programming in it, but I was a big Newton user, and yeah, I've still got some little things I've written, and I've got codes. I've got a code directory that still has, you know, code that I haven't finished. I don't know if I'll ever do that, but yeah, it was a nice one, and I think they were going for kind of a mix there. It was certainly friendlier than some languages.
Yeah, NewtonScript reminded me a lot of TCLTK. I don't know if anyone ever wrote anything in that. TCL being the language and TK being the GUI library and people, but you always use the two of them together, so it was people called it Tickle. And I don't know this for a fact, but I strongly suspect that the developers of the Newton were looking at TCLTK and Smalltalk and some of the related kind of academic languages in that sphere, because it the syntax and the concepts, the object orientation and stuff is all very, very similar to TCL. TCLTK was great. We used it in university for prototyping. It's a great rapid prototyping language if you want to, you know, prototype an app that doesn't necessarily do a whole lot, but it has all the interface and you can kind of see what it's going to do. It's a great language for that. I think there's a lot of TK in modern macOS lineage as well. So if you've used the modern interface builder in on macOS development, they have all these like springs and widgets for controlling how UI elements scale when windows change size and stuff, and how layouts change for, you know, landscape versus portrait on an iPad, things like that. And all that is pretty much lifted right from TK, I think, because it's all the same concepts. Anyway, everything old is new again.
I know a guy who develops systems using Squeak, which is sort of Smalltalk derived. Sounds like, you know, people have heard of it there. Yeah, it's Smalltalk derived with GUI, and it's like sort of an educational language in a way. And I know it borrowed. I've been told the similarities between TK and some of the Squeak elements. I've never played with Squeak, but it sounds interesting. Not a mainstream thing, but it sounds interesting. That's something worth doing a Google search on. I hadn't heard of it at all until this friend of mine mentioned it a couple of years ago. So.
Today was my first introduction to the name of that programming language.
It's a whole environment. It's really a whole environment. It's like its own runtime. It's almost like a little operating system. Like it's its own whole thing. And I think it's all interpreted or heavily. I don't know. It's interesting, but it sounds interesting. I should look deeper into it.
I think Interface Builder on the Next was the first place I saw those kind of dealing with resizing windows and that kind of stuff, like having little springs on stuff. And I didn't know that there was a history to it, and there probably was, but it's still I loved it.
Yeah, it's a great system, and I don't have evidence for this, so take it with a grain of salt. But I think it is well known that Objective-C and a lot of the NextStep environment was based on Smalltalk, and Smalltalk and TCL have a shared lineage as well. So I'm pretty sure that the people that developed Interface Builder on NextStep would have at least seen TCLTK if they weren't actually using it. So I think that might be where the ideas came from, but it's a good system, works to this day.
Excellent. And that ends our discussion of COBOL. No, but what's there?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the other things that happened was the PDP-1 was introduced. Mm-hmm. I saw that in the competing timeline, and I don't know anything about the PDP-1. I just know about the company that made it, and I'm a big fan. Will probably be, forever, deck stuff. But, so let me see. What does this say on computerhistory.org?
I assume it's the first PDP, right? They didn't pull a K-Pro and start with number 2.
No, I don't think so.
Is there a PDP-0?
It says sold for about $120,000, included a cathode ray tube, graphic display, paper tape, I.O., didn't need air conditioning, only required one operator. Wow.
That's quite a feature list for 1960.
I know.
No air conditioning and only one operator. Yeah. Amazing.
And I think they have one, actually, at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. And I think that's where I saw it. I
think the Wikipedia article has an image, and the image says that's where it is Mountain View's Computer History Museum. It's a hexagon screen. Mm-hmm. That is Space War too. I mean, like, you look at that and that is the platform for Space War.
Well, and it's also literally an oscilloscope, which is why it's round. Yeah.
Right. So I guess it has more in touch, more in common with the Vectrex than perhaps a television.
Yeah, honestly, it is. Yeah. I mean, oscilloscopes were kind of the first graphical displays for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. So the PDP-1 was also, one of these 1959, 1960 things, because I think, you can look at it as, you know, developed in 1959, or you can look at it as the first one was delivered to BBN in 1960.
Ah, okay. So, that makes sense.
Yeah. But, you see a lot of PDP 11s. I mean, not a lot, but you know, that seems to be the go-to as far as museums of sorts that have some kind of a system of that era. I guess the 11 was maybe the most prominent, most popular in that line, I'm assuming.
That was my 11.
Oh. Okay, I see.
Yeah, is it... I mean, the shape of the thing is much different. I mean, I guess that this refrigerator is the PDP-1. So the 11 is just like a rack-mounted component, basically, right?
Well, the 11 was a whole family. So you could have an 11 that would be, you know, the later ones, you could get one in a form factor like a PC, basically. Mm-hmm. The original ones were more like a 19-inch rack mount system with the tape reader or the paper tape reader or, you know, things like that. So it depends which of the PDP-11s you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So I might have to turn in my retro computing card at this point, but I don't think I knew that there was a PDP-1 through 7. Like PDP-8 is the earliest one I ever hear us talk about much. I think I assumed in some part of my brain that the 8 stood for like 8-bit or something and not that there was actually 7 before it. So I'm learning.
That's what I would have thought too, actually.
I don't think that you see them very often. I've only seen a 7 once. They had one at the Living Computer Museum in Seattle. And but DEC was so phenomenal with their color schemes. I mean, look even back to this PDP-1. It just, something about it just looks beautiful. The pastels that they pick for these.
Yeah. Yeah. The colors are great. Did they release every model? Does anyone know, like, was there a PDP-4 or a PDP-6? Like, I've never heard of those anywhere.
Well, this apparently is a PDP-6. They're,
look at that.
Looks much more like the 1 than the 11.
Yeah. It does look like there, it seems like there's some skipped numbers here. But,
yeah, maybe they didn't release every single number.
PDP-2, a number reserved for an unbuilt, undesigned 24-bit design.
Okay.
So there still could be a PDP-2.
We've reached we read a Wikipedia portion of the show.
That's right. PDP-8E, I think that's the familiar one to me.
Yeah, I feel like the 8 and the 11 are kind of the ones that everybody knows, so maybe those were the most popular.
Well, the 8 is fascinating because it was the first attempt to make a computer that would be affordable kind of by the masses. Like if you're just a department or something like that, you could afford to buy your own PDP-8. And right. I think it was, don't hold me to this, but I think it was maybe the first model that ever sold more than 50,000 units. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting. It was kind of creeping up on the concept of a personal computer.
Looking at the images that we're viewing for the YouTube stream, it's the colors are quite striking. I always thought Data General did a great job with colors. They, you know, with the Eagle and the other systems, I guess computing systems that they had. It's striking. The PDP-8 looks like something that would be on board, something that absolutely would have been on board the Discovery from 2001.
Mm-hmm. Or you know, the Enterprise from 1967 or whatever it is. I mean, they did a really good job with the colors. There was no reason to do this. I'm certain that that wasn't the thing that flipped people over, you know, from we will not buy this to we will buy this.
No, but I think you're right.
Yeah, it's a good point. I always appreciate gratuitous design, like things that are beautiful that don't need to be. It's always nice to see someone at the company cared. Basically, someone made that happen. You know.
Yeah, it's nice looking back on. I just verified. It occurred to me, and I thought I may be mistaken, but apparently I was not. I remember the Mattel and Television. the game console. I always remember it had an oddball processor that nothing else used. It wasn't a 6502 derivative. It's the, I'm looking at a little reference here, it's the General Instruments CP1600, which was developed by General Instruments and Honeywell in 75, and it was one of the first single-chip 16-bit processors. The overall design is extremely similar to that of the PDP-11. So it's based on the PDP-11, but it's in one chip, you know, whereas there was no CPU to the PDP-11, so to speak. It was all discrete logic. And the article here indicates that it's very close in introduction to the TMS-9900 from the TI-99, which, again, was another 16-bit CPU, but hamstrung in a lot of different ways. But yeah, that's interesting. So basically, if you have an Intellivision, you've kind of got a little PDP-11 in the middle of it.
And to continue the tangent, I think we talked about these guys too, the Electronicas, which was, you know, I think they were, the Soviet Union computers, but they were basically little PDP-11 clones that you put on your desk. You know, they look like a Spectrum, which seems just ridiculous to me somehow, but.
That's anyway. Cool. I don't think I knew about these. I didn't know there were any, like, personal computer clones of the PDP.
I find that it's just even hard to grasp, but I suppose they did, you know, run CPM or something.
I was going to say, did it run, like, fax or something? Like, what would you run on it?
I see it. I see this Russian computer uses a different CPU. They talk about the CPU, a 16-bit CPU, but it's not the same one. As the Intellivision.
Oh, not the same as the Intellivision?
Yeah, it's a different.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Russian name. I guess the CPU is manufactured by a Russian semiconductor.
I actually think the PDP-11 architecture, for some reason, was really big in the Soviet Union. And I'm not quite sure.
Unlike the PDP itself.
That'd be interesting to understand, you know, why that was. But you had these Electronicas, but I don't think these were the only implementations of the 11 architecture over there.
Yeah.
It might be the case that a few of them made it over there and then people learned about computer architecture from it. And so that just sort of became, this is how one designs a computer. I think it was definitely it was a very isolated place in those days. So they probably didn't have a lot of references for how to design a computer.
Well, people's opinion, you know, will vary obviously, but I think if you were looking for a computer architecture in that day and age to emulate, then you could do a lot worse than the PDP-11.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, similarly, probably why the Apple II Plus was cloned so much in every country around the world, just because if you want an inexpensive home computer that can be built with off-the-shelf chips, the 2 Plus is sitting right there. It's an easy thing to clone. So, yeah, makes sense.
All right, let's see what else. There were a couple of things that also came up in the 1960 search. Apparently, maybe the first definition of recommended standard 232, which I didn't know what RS stood for, and now I do.
I didn't either.
I never knew that either.
I didn't know that either.
Wow, nice find.
Yeah. We read Wikipedia for every show.
the Wikipedia roundtable.
This is retro computing enthusiasts react to Wikipedia.
Right.
New genre.
Yeah. Like and subscribe. But what surprises me is that I never even wondered.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I just accepted that, yeah, it was RS. I never thought about it.
Yeah, I don't think there was actually much more to that. This was the first time it was actually defined, and it was refined over the years. It was, was originally not specifically for computers exactly, but for teletypes and stuff.
But the name doesn't make it sound very sure of itself. Like recommended standard, maybe. Yeah. Like why not?
Still, I think it's going to wind up being a big deal. It's my prediction.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to catch on. Yeah.
And another thing, I don't know. I didn't finish reading this. So, does anyone know the name Bob Berner?
No.
So, this person has been referred to sometimes as the father of ASCII, and, you know, has sort of, was involved in some of the committees and, doing some of the proposals for the character codes. But so there was an article he wrote that appeared in the Communications of the ACM, February 1960, a proposal for character code compatibility that actually that was cited as being, I think this may have been the origin of ESCAPE. At any rate, I came across this article, which was written by Bob Beamer. Did I say that right? I don't know if I said it right the first time. But it was basically just sort of outlining his sort of reconstruction of the origins of various characters. So I got to this because some list of like things that happened in 1960 said one of the things that, competing related things that happened in 1960 was the backslash was invented. I thought, well, okay. Discussion here actually does sort of trace that and the curly braces and I think the escape key and stuff to some early, to specifically this like 1960-ish proposal. These were things that were involved in IBM Stretch, another computer I did not know anything about, but there's a number that's associated with this computer, but it was known as Stretch. But it's pretty interesting just to sort of read through the guy who proposed it, going through and trying to find evidence, he proposed it and like that there was no prior art. So the backslash symbol, the square brackets, some other things. Curly braces was the thing that actually sort of triggered this because somebody had written a comment on his blog or something asking, what was the origin of that, and goes down to mostly chasing down the curly braces, but also talking about escape and stuff. And at the end, he says this is a partial explanation for why a parcel marked "Father of ASCII" sometime around 1968 arrived at General Electric in Phoenix and was forwarded to him and had a letter inside starting "Dear Bob." So
nice.
Anyway, it's kind of a neat read, which I have skimmed, but I nevertheless will confidently predict that it is a neat read. So, and I think that's all I had for 1960. I think we're doing pretty well.
The curly brace is actually sort of a funny addition to ASCII because it's really taken way out of context. Like it was out of context the way it was put in because it's a symbol from calculus, but it's not used that way in calculus. It's, you stretch it vertically to accommodate various other things to its right. So it's not useful for its intended use on a computer the way that they put it into the language. And nowadays we use it just as a third or fourth type of parenthesis, just because we need lots of types of parentheses for programming language syntax and such. So it's very strange how we've just all come to accept this thing called a curly brace that has lost all meaning. It's just this abstract symbol, but we all know what it means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting also that, there was a time before a backslash. I mean, sure. Okay, I guess. but anyway, okay. Perhaps we can move on to the next set of topics, unless any other 1960 related things were on people's mind.
Nope, just a thank you to 1960. Thanks for all the good stuff.
Year. Yeah. I sort of feel like it's starting to get a little bit more into our wheelhouses if we do continue this year advancement.
We'll do less and less reading of Wikipedia as the years go by.
Right. I'm pretty sure, I forget now, it might have been like episodes 80 through 89 or something like that. There was some prior set of RCR episodes where we did, concentrate on a year for a while, but I think we came up with the idea too late, so we missed like 1977 and stuff. So maybe this time around we'll get there. Okay, there was some listener feedback, which I guess I'll I'll talk about some of it if we want. So there's on Facebook, Nino posted a review of the DigiRule 2A, or not a, well, sort of like a demo of using it. So there's a little YouTube video of it. It's a pretty interesting thing. Are you guys familiar with this at all?
No.
I have one of those.
Yeah.
I got it as a birthday or Christmas gift. I can't remember. It's pretty fun. If you turn it over on the back, mm-hmm. there's the syntax for programming it in binary. And it's, you know, reminiscent of something like an Altair or whatever, where you program with the ones and zeros, and then you can run it, and it stores it in a little built-on flash. Well, I was going to say a little built-on flash memory, but it actually has a battery. It has a watch battery that powers it.
Yeah, and so this one...
There it is.
Okay. In the video, you can see, actually, there's the stuff on the back. Mm-hmm. And so in the video, he's using a 2A. I have a 2, and the current model is a 2U. And apparently the 2U is actually quite nice. It has a USB connection and a built-in monitor so that you can connect to a terminal and do some assembling online, so you don't actually have to hit all the little buttons.
Cheating.
It seems like it a little bit, but yeah. But yeah, these things are pretty cool. I got mine out to of course, my picture on the stream is very small at this point, but I got mine out to play around with it a little bit, and it's, you know, it's minutes of fun.
So for people that can't see the stream here, can someone summarize mm-hmm. what this thing is? I don't really understand it.
Yeah, so it's that's a good idea. It's a ruler, basically, that has. I mean, like, you know, so that's its gimmick, is that it is, you know, it's a ruler, but it also has these little like push buttons on it. Maybe it's actually better to see the stream, but and you can set the address, so it has a 8-bit address and 8-bit data, and so you can set the address with the little push, you know, whatever they are, moment switches, whatever you call these things, then, you know, like see what's in an address. Store something in an address. It has a little EEPROM that you can save things to and restore things from. And so it has a certain number of things built in, and you can write a little program that will do things with the LEDs on it.
I see. So it's a tiny little computer with like a tiny little front panel basically mm-hmm. on it, but all in the form factor of like a 12-inch ruler.
That's it.
Okay.
Cool. And you program in the opcodes in binary and the data in binary and latch it in. Move to the next address, write your program that way, like the, you know, the founding fathers did with the Altair. Right. Then once you're done, you can run it and it does things. It makes LEDs blink, which, as Paul said, you wind up finding that you're kind of limited in the how spectacular of a LED blinking you can actually accomplish. And then put it away for a little while. But it is kind of fun, though, that you can write little programs with it and run them, and it's all on a little tiny ruler form factor.
Yeah.
Is it a custom CPU, or what's on it?
It is.
I think it is.
Yeah, it's a custom CPU implemented, actually. It's emulated or simulated, so to speak, on the processor chip that's on the ruler.
So it's a virtual platform, so to speak, I guess.
Yeah. But it does gives you the opportunity to do these little switch flips and stores. It does kind of seem like that's almost one step too far. Like, you know, it would be kind of fun to have a PDP 11 or PDP 8 or something that you could have on a ruler. But like, what really is the point of writing a program for, you know, the people who have rulers?
It sort of spoils it a little bit for me that it's emulating it, that it's emulating a custom CPU with a microcontroller. Like, it would be neat if it was like an FPGA that was emulating, or not emulating, but it had implemented like a PDP-11 or something on a ruler. Mm-hmm. That would be neat. But to just have a modern microcontroller that's just emulating some other made-up processor with a front panel feels a little less cool. I don't know. I'm splitting hairs there, I guess. But
it might take something away, knowing you could probably like wire a display to it and like on the side play Doom while it's emulating the that little PvP type machine.
Yeah. I mean, it would actually even be cooler if it was just a front panel for the microcontroller. Like if it was an AVR, you know, whatever microcontroller or something, whatever's on it, it'd be neat to have a front panel for that maybe, although those chips aren't really designed for a front panel, so it probably wouldn't work because you probably can't stop the clock on them and things like that.
The video itself is actually kind of funny because the goal of Nino's video was to add two 24-bit numbers, and so he's worked out, you know, like the opcodes to do it, but he's written it out on paper in this like calligraphy. It's very funny.
He has delightful handwriting, I will say.
Yeah. So check out the video, even if you know, like it has provided a fun exercise. You know, how can you implement this in the, you know, the machine language that this ruler has. So.
And also watch it if you want to know what assembly language looks like if written in a medieval manuscript.
Right.
This is what it would look like.
This might... Oh, actually, here. I'll just put up the Tindy page for the DigiRule, too. So the current DigiRule is the 2U, and it's got a couple of extra things, including this USB connection. But it is not currently viable. So, okay, let's see. So... Garrett wrote to point this out. This is, and I only just sort of got the gist of this, so I haven't actually had much chance to investigate this, but it's someone who is investigating the legacy OS 2200. Does this sound familiar to anybody, the OS 2200?
No.
Not heard of it.
So it is billed as being the magnificent 36-bit ones complement mainframe OS that inherits the legacy of UNIVAC. So the person who has written this up has, you know, actually got an emulator of a mainframe running this operating system going. And it's something other than what the IBM Z machines run. You know, it's a different thing. And apparently it's more fun than the whatever that is, MVS.
That's not a high bar.
Yeah. But it's pretty interesting actually to sort of look through the investigation of, you know, this person is learning OS 2200 along the way. And one thing I was sort of skimming this over trying to find and haven't yet found is like what emulator is actually being used. Like, you know, how could I participate in this? And I'm not sure. But it may be in here somewhere. But there's sort of a little list of, you know, what the 2200 commands are and some of the languages that are in it. And it's sort of a series that's partway through, and it's actually happening now. This is somebody who goes by Sunset. So part one is the road to Unisys Dorado. Part two is One's Complement is the loneliest representation. And there are six planned parts. Three are written already. And then there's a little side note, which was, I mean, this is very recent. This is happening now, basically, on the different mainframes, you know, so there's the big, you know, IBM mainframe company, or different mainframe companies, I guess. So IBM is still going, still making Z-based machines. There's Unisys and Fujitsu, Hitachi, Atos, which has bought Group Bull, which I didn't know. You know, this is a world that's in slightly a different dimension from mine, but it's pretty interesting. I'm looking forward to reading all the words here and not just skimming them.
It's certainly eye-opening as far as how big the mainframe world was that none of us probably saw, because I don't understand any of the words in these paragraphs. Like, I've never heard of any of these systems or any of these languages or operating systems or anything. It's crazy. Mm-hmm.
Which actually, that reminds me of something that we didn't mention that Jeremy posted in the chat earlier. He said a friend of my dad's did IT for a large Canadian bank and managed a move from a mainframe to Unix in the 90s. He found the culture clashing and was unnerved by an error like "the child is dead." But I mean, that's kind of relevant here, you know, that it really is. It's just like, it is a really different world. You know, the mainframe people and the Unix people. The Unix people were like the whippersnapper upstarts that, you know, whatever, didn't want to play by the rules or whatever. But and that's very much not how they are now, you know, yeah. At least from our perspective. But it really is like just a different mindset.
Well, and people talked about that, like we've all heard the stories about the culture clash between, you know, mainframes and the smaller mini computer systems and how difficult that transition was culturally for companies because, you know, the mainframe people had the lab coats and they had all of the prestige and so on. And they cultivated this mystery of, you know, wizards in a tower running these systems. But a blog like this is really brings that home, like what a completely different world it was. At one of the earlier posts, she said about how the system that she's running was like intentionally Baroque or something was how she put it. Like it reveled in how weird it was and how difficult it was to understand. And that's, yeah, here, this line here, I like, they are unapologetically strange systems. Integers are represented as one's complement and the machine word is 36-bit. The operating system is proudly Baroque and more than a little intimidating. That's great writing, but I think it also really sells how strange these systems were. And I almost wonder, this also makes me wonder if there was a little bit of intentionality at some point here, because engineers always joke about how complicated, hard to understand systems create job security, which is, you know, not really true, but we like to joke about that being true. Mm-hmm. And that almost feels like what's happening here. I mean, if you create a system like this that's so difficult to understand, then you're going to have to keep going back to the same set of people to operate it.
Yeah, I would like to do this. I would like to try to spin up a machine and run this and learn a little bit about this. I think that seems like a fun project. And you know, it is a new area to discover. Though I have this unfounded belief that, you know, now that we are in the modern age and, you know, there are computers all around us, all of this stuff should be intuitive and easy and simple and I will be able to figure it out. And it isn't that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what makes me not want to try what she's doing right now is the documentation situation. Like, if you can find documentation on these obscure mainframe OSs from the 60s, that documentation is going to be in the form of, you know, 15, 12-inch three-ring binders on some shelf somewhere. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's any, like, walkthroughs or tutorials for how to use this stuff, so you might be really struggling to find documentation.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Tony sent this over email. It's a video of a 3.5-inch floppy disk assembly line. I've never seen this before. Has anyone seen disks being made?
Not really, no.
Is it you say a 3.5 or 5.25-inch?
It's 3.5. I would really like to see the 5.25 assembly line, but at any rate, yeah. So you see all the little robots putting these things together.
I know a little bit about how they make the Mylar film with the magnetic layer on it, like the business end of the floppy. I know that because I did actually look into doing that at one point. I was curious how difficult would it be to make a floppy disk in your own garage. Mm-hmm. The answer is it's extremely difficult because that process actually has to be done in like a level 5 clean room or something. So that was kind of the deal breaker, but it's done centrifugally. So they have the ring of Mylar film and they spin it up. And they deposit the magnetic film on it while it's spinning, which creates a very, very, very thin, very even distribution of it. And then there's like 58 different exotic chemical processes required to seal it and do all this other stuff. It involved a clean room and a whole lot of terrifying chemicals that I probably can't even buy. So that was the end of that idea for a project. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So this video seems to be focusing more on the mechanical side of it, like the plastic covers and so on for the discs.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised when I was looking through this at just how many steps there are. I mean, like, you know there are, it doesn't seem like there are that many pieces, but you know, there's like the top and the bottom and the gate and the, you know, the padding inside, and then you know, they have to be secured together. And so
I guess dramatically more complex than a 5.25 or 8-inch floppy. I mean, I would think, given it's just a sleeve with the lining inside, no moving shutter, no spring.
Right. Yeah. That does seem like that's the main difference, is the shutter and the spring. and the rigidity. Let's see. So another thing that Tony sent us a few things. I thought this was pretty excellent. Apparently, elephant. You know, elephant discs, right? They published a book, I guess. It's called The Secrets of Perfect Memory. And it's sort of semi-serious, semi-not, sort of talking about the floppy disk technology. And it's got these weird illustrations in it. But at the same time, it really is, you know, it's actually giving you information about, like, how disks work.
This is bizarre and fascinating. This was an actual book that they published?
I guess.
At some point?
I never saw it advertised. They never waved the flag around about their book, if that's odd or not. Yeah. I never heard of it. It's strange.
So they have a little, you know, a page here that says the byte alphabet, and they list the letters and you know, give off and ons for, I don't know what, you know, maybe MFM representations of these. I don't know what they are, but the archive.org description just says promotional book by Elephant Memory Systems describing floppy disks. So, but anyway, I thought that was I would take a look at it if you have a moment. It's not super long. It's 74 pages, but they are very light pages.
It reminds me of a lot of those Usborne books for kids, like where they would show memory registers with little robots sticking index cards in mailboxes and stuff. It reminds me of that, but with like more adult avant-garde artwork, I guess. Like there's a lot of very curious and bizarre artwork in it.
Yeah. Here's the description of, this ties in a little bit with the floppy making process, you know, like there's a picture of like, you know, someone in this weird gas mask, and it says, you know, dust is trouble, and talks about, you know, like, don't touch the media, and it's little images of like laser deflections off of the spinning disc to figure out like where it bends when it spins and things. So, pretty interesting. Don't touch the shiny parts. Chapter 5. anyway, yeah. Thank you, Tony, for bringing this up. I would never have come across this.
I would love to see a physical copy of that, because it looks like it must be an incredible book, honestly.
Yeah. But there probably weren't many of them, and I appreciate that somebody sacrificed it for the archive. Okay. I think will probably be enough for now. We'll, you know, return to feedback next time. We're ready for items of interest and news. And with all of our preparation, who knows if there are any? Okay, Earl, you have put something there.
Oh, so you mine is first. Okay.
Yeah.
Little historical context. So, there was this company called Commodore. You guys might have heard of it. Mm-hmm. And they're, so their 8-bit series of computers, you would have thought, based on the timing and the way that technology was starting to pivot, that the Commodore 128 would have been the final 8-bit computer for Commodore. But there actually was another computer that they were working on, and it went around, 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 and finally got killed. It was called the Commodore 65. And it was going to be the super-duper-duper 8-bit computer with even a more advanced BASIC and more RAM capability, and I think maybe stereo SIDs and the sound chip and a variety of other neat new enhancements. And it didn't see the light of day, but there were some prototypes that were made, and some of those escaped out into the wild. And for a while there, you could find them, like in my early days of retro computing when I got into it, like around 2000, you could find a Commodore 65 for, I think, what I would call painful money. It wasn't horrible, but, you know, it wasn't cheap. Now, if you see one auctioned, it's for insane money, like hundreds of thousands of dollars, if I remember
like
right.
Like Apple One money?
Yeah. Well, not quite approaching Apple One money, but, you know, it has a similar mystique in the Commodore world to what the Apple I does in the Apple world. So there was an outfit making a computer, a modern computer, that was inspired, I guess you'd say, by the Commodore 65. And it's called the Mega 65. It took several years of work on this to actually get it out the door, but apparently it is now out the door. And I watched a kind of a first look video of a Mega 65 on a YouTube channel that I really enjoy called Retro Recipes. And the computer was in the video unboxed and plugged in, powered up. You know, the host of the video walked through what it looks like on the inside. Has apparently a mechanical keyboard that feels really nice. It does have a 3.5-inch floppy drive in it. And the trick is that they don't make those anymore. So when he opened it up, he found out that it does look like it was either new old stock or maybe even refurbished. But I think the computer is very interesting. I think the price point is maybe more than I would want to damage my pocketbook. I think it was 666 euros, if I remember right. Mm. So by the time you got one shipped to you, you know, you'd be talking $700 to $800 US dollars, probably, is my guess. The little video clip that Paul is playing, for those who are listening to the podcast, the host was actually sniffing the computer as he took it out of the box. Apparently that, you know, electronics new in the box smell is a big part of the experience for him.
Interesting.
And I think here he's showing the part of the brain that lights up with the olfactory senses, and saying that that's a bigger part of nostalgia than what we realize. Anyway.
That's interesting.
Yeah, the Mega 65, fascinating. If you wish there had been a Commodore 65, then in a way your wish has come true, because they have created a modern-day incarnation of it. Apparently about 40 times faster than the Commodore 64. It is based off of an FPGA, so on that, Quinn, you would have got your wish. It's not a microcontroller acting like a processor. It's actually a processor implemented in hardware description language on an FPGA. So, fun.
This thing looks really awesome, honestly. Like, the production value on it is outstanding. Like, it looks really nice. I'm honestly sorely tempted by this. Would it be Commodore 64 compatible as well, or do you know?
I think that it is Commodore 64 compatible, but I would recommend checking the fine print.
Okay. And just for giggles, I checked, and the euro is actually pretty soft right now, so that would be about 650 US plus shipping.
Yeah. So, for what, you know, if there's things in Europe that you're interested in buying, right now the dollar is doing pretty darn well against the European currencies, so might not be a bad time.
Yeah, now's the time. I mean, a couple of years ago, this would have been double that. This would have been 1,200 US, because it's usually the other way. So, yeah, it's surprising how low the euro is right now.
So I think you may have said, but it went through my head. I believe I had heard that this was on the way. I mean, I've like you, I've seen the Commodore, you know, the C65. It wasn't on sale in stores, but I mean, it seems like they had like a couple of hundred that got out, and I used to see them on eBay, and I observed what you did as far as price, and that was, you know, 15 years ago. Now it's quite different, but I feel like I heard that this was on the way. Is this currently being produced, or did it have a run and now it's not, and this is something that he found from when it was in production, or is it still in production? Do you know?
Well, I wasn't quite sure about that, because when you go to the webpage, it says pre-order. So I didn't know if the one that he got to show off on the YouTube channel was early on the production line, or maybe a slightly pre-production model. But the fact that he had one, and it was not a prototype, it was the actual molded plastic case and all the internal goodies means that if it's not available yet, it must be very close.
Right. And I guess because I know I've looked at the being interested in the, before this project or the C-65 or, you know, what it may have been. You know, I've looked into the specs, and I assume it's, in fact, you, I, obviously they've taken the ROMs and, you know, looked at the hardware, and it's a FPGA implementation of that system, which by nature, I think, is Commodore 64 compatible. But it's still 8-bit. But it's interesting that the, I guess this unit, being an FPGA, it's it says it can run, what, 40 times faster than a C64. I know that the actual, you know, Commodore C65 was faster, but it was only, I think the, it's the same CPU, but I think it's running at like 4 or 6 megahertz or something like that.
Yeah, it wasn't that much faster. I think it was a 4510 CPU, if I remember right.
And, okay.
So in the 65XX family, and it wouldn't have been 40 times faster for sure.
Yeah, and I, like I remember thinking, oh, I thought it was strange at the time that they hadn't, you know, they didn't use like a 65C816, you know, 16-bit. They it's still an 8-bit 6502 compatible, but still it had like the large palette, and as you said, I think a couple of SIDs. It would have been a really fun machine, I think, definitely. And it's cool that it exists as it does now. And I've thought, you know, I picture like how much can you enjoy? Like you sort of, you would have your own, but it's not quite the same as if, you know, as if it had taken off, but it's cool. I like it. I think it would have been, you know, people talk about the different 8-bit computers. This might've been, you know, I think the Enterprise 128 is what I consider to be arguably the most powerful 8-bit computer, not so much because of its CPU, but some of the other things with it. I would say, it seems to me that if, you know, if this had happened, this would have arguably been the most powerful 8-bit, you know, computer as far as graphics, sound, and just overall speed. So that's cool. I wish it had made it. You know, it had actually hit the shelves, kind of in between the C64 and the Amiga a little bit.
I've always really loved the idea of a computer that has the 8-bit computer simplicity, but the power to do elaborate graphics without having to do incredible technical wizardry, like the problem with all the
buffers.
Yeah, like being able to fill the whole screen with pixels as fast as you want, basically, without having to do crazy stunts and be a, you know, an absolute expert on the hardware like you had to be back in those days to have that, but still have the simplicity of an 8-bit machine, I think is a dream that probably a lot of us have. And machines like this get really close to that. Like if it's fast enough to where I can write a naive loop of 6502 code that can fill the screen with pixels at 60 FPS, like that's all I want. Because now I can just have fun writing simple assembly code and produce neat stuff without having to, you know, understand the horizontal blanking registers and whatever other, you know, craziness is in there.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it is tempting, but it is expensive. I mean, it is nice, but...
Yeah. I mean, they pulled out all the stops on the production, I will say. I mean, mechanical keyboard and, like, they had injection molding, you know, dies made for this, which that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars, and injection molded cases and everything. I mean, it's pretty nice. It's tempting, but it's still a lot of money.
Yeah, I think, the U.S. dollar, I think, is... I've checked it against the... yen too. It's also, you know, if you want to buy something from Japan, also a good time to do it. Don't know how long that's going to last.
Yeah, or Canada. The exchange rate with Canada right now is bonkers also.
I think I have the next thing. So Tim Colgrove of the Byte Shop has acquired and or, you know, reassembled Lisa 1 with the floppy drives. So this was, you know, the predecessor to the Macintosh. There was, I think, a couple of television ads that featured the Lisa, and you know, some of these print ads you'll see too. They have 5 1/4 inch discs.
And Kevin Costner.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Not quite understanding how to use a mouse.
Are those what they call the Twiggy?
They are
drives.
Yes.
Wow.
So, these are super rare. I mean, like this is another one of those like very expensive things. They mostly. they mostly don't exist because I think Apple made just like, it was like a free upgrade from the Lisa 1 to Lisa 2, and that would replace these drives with a 3.5-inch drive. The Lisa 2 also did not have the word Lisa on the front, you know, so that's the frustrating thing about that. Like, the Lisa 1 is nice because it actually has a badge that says Lisa on it. But it's in great condition, and he installed Lisa OS 1.2 from floppies onto the profile drive. So I think we were talking a couple times ago about the profile drive and how it was, you know, you often see it perched atop a Lisa like this, but it's clearly designed for an Apple III. It's like a piece of an Apple III sitting on top of a Lisa. It's very weird. But anyway, it's this is a pretty remarkable video because you really, you know, it's like a modern high-res video of these things that you really can't see, and you know, put together by somebody who's demonstrating it for you, understands it. So it's I'd recommend watching the video, and in fact this is actually out in his shop, like, you know, so you can also visit his shop, and it's you know, for me it's not very far away, but I mean, if you're in Boston, you can stop by and see the thing, which is pretty amazing. I have not done that, but I am amazed by that fact.
That's super cool.
The Twiggy drives themselves are really cool things. If anyone's not familiar with them, they're kind of like, they took the 5.25 drive concept and tried to see how far we could push it in terms of performance. And so for speed, it's got two heads on it, but they're not above and below the disk like you would expect. They're front and back. They're 180 degrees opposite the spindle of each other. So the floppy disks have two windows in them, which is very, very strange. Mm-hmm. When you look at them, it's like someone described a floppy disk to an alien, and that's what they drew. It's kind of what they look like, which I imagine makes them difficult to handle also, because we're kind of right where you want to grab the disk, there's an additional window that you can't touch. But in addition to that, they had a variable speed spindle. So much like the 3.5-inch Mac drives did, they varied the speed depending on what track you were on. And so outer tracks held more data than inner tracks did, which most traditional floppy disks that have a constant speed spindle, a lot of the disk is actually wasted because you're storing the same amount of data on a small inner track as you are on a much larger linear distance outer track. And so these variable spindle disks cram a lot more storage onto the same disk. So more storage and a lot more speed because of the two heads. So really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know I've read a lot of, you know, the Apple history books. I may have read all of them, but there's a great, there's hundreds of pages I've heard about the development of the Twiggy, and, you know, it was pushing the limit, as you say, so far. Just mechanically, reliability was a big issue. It was so complex. And I know Jobs, he was just passionate about, you know, staying the course with this drive, you know, their own custom, you know, make the floppy all it could be. And, yeah, I think he was not joined in the end by many. I think he was the kind of the torch bearer of this drive. And it was, I think, a happy thing, despite, you know, indeed, it's the most advanced, you know, 5.25-inch drive I would imagine that exists. But yeah, I think it was a happy move when they went to the standard 3.5, which was, you know, I think the Mac was probably the first mainstream computer that used the 3.5-inch microfloppy, unless I'm much mistaken. But yeah, the Twiggy. And actually, there's and you may be aware, but there were some prototype Macs. I have seen someone who has one do a video on it, and the original Macintosh had a single Twiggy drive in it, 5.25-inch, and that system exists. There are a couple of them. And that's quite a thing to look at, the original Mac footprint with a Twiggy drive as its internal storage. Yeah. It's quite striking. But, yeah, so. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, it looks just bizarre.
YouTube watchers. Yeah, it's quite a look there. And on the Macintosh, I noticed that the 5.25-inch drive on the original Lisa, it has a button that you push, and then it communicates with the operating system, and then it ejects the disk. You don't manually eject it, so it's kind of like the 3.5 on the Mac in that regard. But I see on the Macintosh, the Twiggy does not have the button, so it's entirely handled, I guess, in software, just like the 3.5. You just tell it to eject. Yeah.
Well, and the Lisa power is like that too. The power button does not actually control the power. So Tim was saying also that you can see in the video frame that I stopped it at, it's actually just a high density Maxell disk. It is not actually a Twiggy disk, but he managed to get, you know, he cut a hole in a regular high density disk and said it was basically working.
I was going to ask about that, because I imagine that that kind of floppy media would be nearly impossible to find.
Yeah.
It is. There was someone I almost managed to buy some from, because he'd come across there's some warehouse or something, and, you know, storage space or something that he had come across, and had, it was like, you know, old store inventory or something, and so he had a lot of really interesting boxes of like 3M floppies and things, but so I have seen them. They were sold for a while, these, you know, like Twiggy discs, but this one was created. And so Tim was saying actually that he has not experienced any particular difficulty with reliability on this, but that is the lore, is that there was, that they were unreliable enough that they wanted to switch to something else.
Well, the stories I'd heard more than, my floppy's failed, it's not working, it's tales of the physical drive itself, you know, actually failing significantly, which of course would cause the floppy to fail. But yeah, I think it was not so much a working drive was writing shoddily as far as I can see, but like the drives themselves would just fail, not, you know, dramatically sort of. There's a lot going on there, I guess, a lot of precision.
Okay, so I went and looked it up, and it's, so the 5 1/4 inch Twiggy was 872K, which is pretty amazing when you consider that the first gen 3 1/2 inch discs were 400K, and even the second gen 3 1/2 inch discs were 800K. So 872K off of a 5 1/4 inch floppy is pretty amazing. So yeah, they were very impressive discs.
Yeah.
But that probably contributed to their unreliability, because in order to do that, they must have been packing that data very tightly. And of course, the tighter you pack the data on the disk, the less reliable it gets. And that might have been part of its issues.
Mm-hmm. So Commodore had a couple of drives that they were quad density, which I think takes a specific media, although people have said that you could use double density drives and it, you know, mostly works. But trying to remember the drive numbers, I think the 2031 was one of them. Maybe I'm off on that. Mm. But it was interesting that they squeezed an awful lot of capacity onto a 5 1/4 also. I think it was a megabyte, if I remember right.
Wow.
Yeah, there were some 1.2 megabyte floppies later, 5 1/4 inch floppies. That's right. I don't remember which systems used it, but I remember hearing about those. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I used to use those on PCs, on like a regular, like a PCAT or whatever. I think 1.2 was the high density.
PC floppies, yeah, PCs were 1.2, weren't they, on the 5 1/4s? Yeah, that sounds right.
And then I think on the 3 1/2, I think the only time I've ever heard of it, well, I think there were some other Unix workstations, but the next systems had the 2.88 megabyte 3 1/2 inch. It was like a high density. I don't know what the term was. It wasn't just high density. It was twice the capacity of a 1.44 megabyte. The standard 3.5 inch double-sided disk on DOS was 1.44, but there were 2.88 drives. I think Commodore used, well, I think the Amiga, one of the Amigas, the Amiga 4000 or the Tower version had one of those drives as well, I think. But
and it wasn't the 2031. It was the SFD 1001. I've actually I've got one of those that got refurbished with a local Commodore expert repair person here in the Pacific Northwest, and it works, and it does work with double density media, although I wouldn't feel like it's reliable. Like, you know, I wouldn't like put anything super important on it, but I did get a megabyte worth of storage. Trying to look up when that drive came out, but it was quad density. And I think if you go on eBay or other places like that, you can find some quad density media if you're patient.
Yeah, we used to do that in the 3 1/2 inch days. when HD, when the high density drives came along, we would buy the double density discs, and you know, the high density discs had two holes in them, and that was their that was how the drive knew what kind of disc it was. So we would buy the double density discs because they were cheaper and punch another hole in it, and that worked, but you had about a 20% chance of the data just not being there every time you put it in the drive, because the media was not the same, so it didn't really work very well. But you know, we were kids.
So big word, I think the magnetic coercivity is different on the high densities than it is on the double density. So
yeah,
kind of like almost the difference between, you know, standard cassette tapes and the chrome or the metal tapes. I think they had a different recording method, and you could swap them back and forth, but you wouldn't get optimal results.
Interesting. I feel like I understand the disc analogy better than the tape analogy. I never really quite understood what the chrome switch was all about. I just, you know, like sometimes when I really liked something, I would get a chrome tape and I would put it on the chrome tape, and I probably didn't even use the right writing method for the chrome tape. There's a folklore.org is a site that has a bunch of Andy Hertzfeld written pieces, and there was one that relates a little bit to what we were talking about a little bit ago about the you know, switching from the Twiggy to the 3.5-inch floppy, which relates a story basically of you know, like Steve Jobs saying like, we want to keep going with the Twiggy drive, and the Mac team panicking a little bit about this, and actually talking a little bit to Sony about their 3.5-inch drive, and what made it into a story was kind of that they were talking to one of the people from Sony, and then I don't remember it exactly, and I'm not really skimming it successfully here, but apparently like Steve Jobs was coming by, and so they had the rep like hide in the closet so that Steve wouldn't realize that they were talking to a 3.5 drive person. So George and Larry apologized to Komodo-san for their unusual request. No problem, he replied. But American business practices, they are very strange. anyway, yeah. And now, a word from our sponsor.
You want to start small, but think tall. That's your plan with computers that can grow along with you.
How are you going to do it?
Well, you're going to PS to it.
With the IBM PS2.
You want to network up and network down. Share information with other towns.
The solution is IBM. The solution is IBM.
When Apple invented the personal computer, we were all alone in the world. But soon it seemed that everybody was trying to build a better Apple. Well, somebody finally did. Lisa from Apple. So advanced it puts us right back where we started. Alone again. Soon there'll be just two kinds of people. Those who use computers and those who use apples.
College isn't all fun and games, you know.
Oh, yes. Very serious, Daddy.
That's why I...
We got my computer.
IBM introduces the Personal System 2 that fits a college room and budget.
I'll do my term papers with it.
And...
my lab reports.
With power and graphics that earn top grades.
And?
Graph economic problems.
And?
Write home once a week.
Smart girl.
The newest member of the IBM Personal System 2 family.
And we're back. So the host retro computing gift idea this time is an Epson LX350. It's an actually new Epson printer that is sort of retro-compatible. So Earl, I think, knows a little bit more about this than I do. So maybe I will let Earl talk about it a bit.
Well, there are still use cases for impact printers, so they still make them. This is a 9-pin, so, you know, very classic kind of concept here. Dot matrix printer from Epson. And the thing that caught my eye was the different options that you have for hooking up to it. It has a parallel port, like most of us are used to. It also has a serial port, which you will occasionally find an old retro computer, like maybe a CPM system or something like that, that wants to have a serial connection, so it's got that. And if you want to run with the whippersnappers that we were talking about earlier, it's even got USB. So you can connect to it however you want to. Now, it's not a wide carriage model. Looks like the standard 8.5. And it is very fast, though, 347 characters per second. So if you're printing 80 column lines, that would be 4 lines per second. So the paper is just going to fly through this thing.
That is fast. Is it tractor feet or is it plain paper?
I think it's either, if I remember right.
It definitely has a sheet feeder. You can see the sheet feeder, the back part of it.
So back office, it's ideal for back office applications needing continuous paper or multi-part stationery. So it's got to be tractor feed.
Yep.
Interesting. So, I didn't know you could run tractor feed that fast. That's crazy.
And, you know, it's kind of nice looking. And the other thing that I was thinking about is it's new in the box. And the price isn't ridiculous at $215. That's not a ton of money. So it just seemed like... Now, I did find in my collection some Oki data printers, the Microline series, and they work. So that's actually probably the only reason that one of these Epsons isn't already sitting in my house. because I found an alternative. But I thought this was really neat. The fact that, you know, you're always looking for retro-ish stuff that you could get new in the box. This is truly new in the box, and not even with 30-year-old components that are new old stock. This is, like, presumably not too far off the assembly line.
I mean, it sounds like it's being produced now, right? I mean, it's one of their currently produced products, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you could even call customer support or tech support.
Theoretically, yeah.
Well, and importantly, you can get ribbons for it, right? Because, like, come to KFest and, you know, we'll give you 7 ImageWriter 2s. Please take them. But good luck finding ribbons for them that aren't dried out. So this is neat because you can buy ribbons for it.
So that was a fascinating thing I found on the Microlines, though, the Oki Datas. I went out looking for ribbons and instantly found ribbons. And not only did I find them, but they were cheap. It was something like 6 for $12. Yeah, it was amazing. I got them. I, you know, popped it in. I was wondering, is this going to be all dried out? But no, it was great.
Were they new old stock somewhere?
That's hard to say. I don't know if they were new old stock or if they were recently produced. I just know that they work great. I actually used it to, my son had a birthday, and I thought one fun thing would be to print him out one of those print shop banners. You know, a big old happy birthday. So I printed it. That out, and he really enjoyed it, but I think it was probably still more fun for the old man than it was for him.
Maybe he enjoyed seeing you have fun.
Yeah, exactly.
We had my wife's 40th birthday. We had a gathering, and I used ImageWriter 2 and the GS with PrintShop to print out a color PrintShop banner. I had found a box of sealed 20 sealed color ImageWriter 2 ribbons like 7 years before, and they work well enough, so that was fun. I will say that Oki Data Microline, every time I go in, I seem to take a photograph of this thing. I was cleaning out my photo library, and I see I've got at least 14 photographs of this printer. They have like 4 Oki Data Microline printers with tractor fed 3-layer carbons, like they're the receipt, and then they have an internal, and then there's a third, and it's printing ink. It's not it's not just doing impact. I presume that they're getting ribbons from somewhere. Those printers have been there the near 20 years I've been going there, and they print me a receipt every time. It's interesting. So maybe they're still made. Maybe.
Yeah, some of the more popular models. Yeah, maybe somebody's still making their ribbons out there.
I mean, the printers are definitely old, like they're the same. They're I think they're vintage, but they hold up. They need those ribbons.
I wonder if, speaking of PrintShop, I wonder what the driver situation would be for this. Like, if you plugged it into your Apple II, is PrintShop going to talk to it? I mean, presumably one of the OG Epson drivers is probably backward compatible enough to work, but I'd be curious about that.
it is kind of funny to see, you know, a number as high as 350 after LX too. I mean, it's like, okay, well, this is the future continued, and I wasn't paying attention.
I did wonder about that too. I wondered, Quinn, if they had something like FX85 compatibility, or, you know, something like, how would it react to the old Epson escape codes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if it just sees escape codes on the serial port, is it going to do the right thing with that? Or is it expecting like some USB modern driver version of communication?
Yeah, because any modern computer is going to only think in terms of pages, you know, as far as its print. Whereas that wasn't the case back in the day so much. I would bet money, without looking into it, that it has, you know, a backwards compatibility on the serial. It seems likely.
Because I mean, that standard, that Epson communication standard, is so entrenched that it seems unlikely they would give it up. You know, they would probably support
it. Everybody copied it. You know, they had to have compatibility. Yeah. And of course, if you really are feeling fancy, you can spring for the 24-pin version, 9-pin. I doubt there's a 24-pin version, but funny.
I think there actually was.
Oh, really?
I think there was a 24-pin modern dot matrix that was available when I was looking around on Amazon. But I was thinking, 24-pin, that's too new school for me.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
9 pins is enough for anybody.
I kind of want to see video of this thing printing, like four lines a second dot matrix. That is so fast. Like,
there was a video. I found a YouTube of this particular model, and it was actually a retro channel. I don't remember which one. Sorry.
Oh, cool. No, I'll Google that, because that looks like fun.
And also, while I was here, I looked to see if you could get paper, and you can. You know, you can still buy boxes of continuous paper.
It's not cheap.
Super cheap. But it isn't. It's not ridiculous. It's just not cheap.
I've seen it at Staples in person. Like, that's, I guess you're looking at a, you might be looking at a,
it
well, the brand of, that you're looking at is Staples, but I've been in Staples and seen it on the shelf.
I mean, that's pretty cheap. That's $50. That's 2,500 pages, right? Like, that's three lifetime supply.
Take you forever to go through
it. Tractor feed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've got a little stash. I've probably got, you know, maybe, I don't know, five times this. This is a little stack that I've got, the continuous feed. But this is new old stock. If you got the paper that you're showing there on the screen from Staples, it'd probably be really nice and crisp and white, whereas this has... I need to retrobrite this.
Yeah. Yeah, I have, you know, I have a little box with, you know, a couple inches worth in it, and I may never get through that. But
I just forgotten how much fun dot matrix printing was, the sound and the... extremely slow speed how the paper comes out. Just everything about it was just a fun little dance.
Yeah.
I mean, I still remember the feeling of being able to print stuff like that. I mean, we take it for granted now that anything that's on your screen can be on paper at the click of a mouse. But that was a big, big deal, that, you know, to be able to have some terrible approximation of what's on your screen on paper and hard copy. And just... that was very, very exciting. And I really loved being able to print anything at all.
Okay, so when you're done buying your printer, then we can turn our attention to eBay. And Blake, you have the first auction to talk about there.
Yes. So I remember when I was I guess it was the sixth grade or something like the same. There was a friend of mine that he was a Atari 8-bit guy. And at the time I had a TI at the time, but, anyway, we would, you know, talk about the computers. And he was always talking about, games he would copy from friends with, this software called Happy Backup. And I'm sure all the Atari people are aware of the Happy Backup software, or whatever the exact name was. I think there might even have been a ROM that you could put, like, replace the disk drive's ROM with something from Happy, and it would make it able to back up more. Anyway, so I that name stuck in my mind. And when I had an Atari ST in the late 80s, I remember seeing ads for this thing called the Discovery cartridge from Happy Computers, the company's Happy Computers. And the ST had a cartridge port that was not super widely used, but one of the devices for it was this Discover cartridge. And basically, it's a copy cartridge that has it has its own interface on the back of the unit for disk in, disk out. Basically, it works like a, I guess it's a disk controller. You, like you plug a line from the computer. The computer's floppy connector into this box, and then it had the outputs. And basically, I think it could take over your drives with its alternate controller when the software told it to. And it was interesting in that I think it could basically copy anything. It would make anything you had any level of protection for the ST, it could copy it. It also would copy 8-bit 5 1/4-inch Atari discs if you had. If you plugged in a 5 1/4-inch Atari drive, and I think I'd heard on Usenet of people that took it further and were able to copy other formats with this, not just I think the stated supports are Atari and 8-bit and ST discs, but it also was able to copy Mac disks, and it was able to take unlike as Quinn mentioned earlier, the Mac had a 3-speed variable speed 3.5-inch drive, and it was able to read those disks, even though the ST drives couldn't change their speed. It could read them with the controller, and it would write them out to this magic format disk, which was 1-speed. It was a sort of a bridge format, and some of the Atari ST Macintosh emulators on the ST could read this. I know Magic Sack from Gadgets by Small, Dave Small, was the first cartridge that had Mac ROMs, and the ST could emulate. Or emulate's not quite the right word, but it could sort of become a Mac. But the disk format was always wonky, so I think some of these systems that followed could read this full full capacity disk format. And apparently, looking into it further, this Discovery cartridge, some versions of it actually they would act as one of these Mac cartridges. It would take Mac ROMs, and it itself with software would let you turn the ST into a Mac, and it would read its own disks. So it seemed very interesting. I remember seeing an ad for it. The eBay auction is for, it's a not new in box. It's used. It seems to work. It's $250 with $12 shipping in the US. But I think it was, much beyond what I, could have spent. I don't recall spending a lot of time thinking of, how to get hold of one of these, but it's an interesting piece of tech, especially if you, started with the 8-bit Atari and moved into the ST, as people often followed the brand, you were sort of covered from one to the other, so with the backup capabilities. So I thought it was pretty interesting. Just a fully, basically a disk controller, alternate disk controller that could take over the drives, I guess. So I thought that was an interesting find. And has anyone ever heard of this? Or I don't know if any of you guys ever were ST users at any point.
No, this is all news to me.
Okay, yeah, I actually have an Atari ST and an Amiga within less than 8 feet of each other, which I think is typically a dangerous scenario. But they coexist without blowing each other up. So. The war was real, I remember, online back then. But so there you go.
And I think maybe you said this, but it's the same Happy that made like the add-ons that you could put in the Atari 8-bit drives, right? Like the 810.
Yeah, yes, it's the same Happy Computers. I remember the names. It sounded so strange. This friend of mine would talk about Happy Backup, and he had some ROM in his disk drive that let it, you know, do copies on his 8-bit Atari. I wasn't an 8-bit Atari guy, and I knew very little about it at the time. This back in, like, we're talking about this back in like 1984. But yeah, and so it's definitely the same company. That name stuck out, so that's what caused it to kind of catch my attention when I first saw it in like Start magazine or whatever, you know, in like the late 80s. This is the first time I've ever seen one on eBay. It seems like quite a device if you, you know, were an ST user back then and like to copy things.
This reminded me of something which I heard this story. It was actually, I think, Tony Diaz who told me this, so I'm not going to be able to, you know, follow up. But you could actually, you know, he would be at copy parties where they would take two Commodore drives, they would put them next to each other, they would somehow set them in motion, and then they could copy by themselves with no computer connected, you know, because they have a little 6502 in them, and they could run a little copy program without actually occupying the Commodore's time.
Yeah, I know that there are some backup systems for the and some speed up systems for the Commodore. I mean, Earl obviously knows much more than I do about all things Commodore, but I've heard of different ROMs, sort of like this Atari, that the Atari set up with its ROM that, you know, would enable copying. I had never actually heard of what you described, but I'm not surprised. It had its own little CPU. The board, I took a 1541 drive apart because there was it was sticking, the speed was wrong or something, and I, you know, unsuccessfully tried to get it working, and the circuit board in that thing it's pretty significant. It's big. It looks like it might be an actual computer board.
It is its own little computer. It's got a 6502. It's got some ROM and RAM, and it's I've heard tell of those copy programs like you're talking about, Paul, where you could kick it off and the drives handle it. I've never actually seen one in action. That would be fun.
Well, and the little computer that's in the 1541 has its own built-in disk drive, so I think that makes it actually a better computer than the Commodore 64.
That's right. Yeah, I wonder, that'd be kind of cool if you could add as a peripheral to your disk drive like a SID chip. And a...
Exactly. All it's missing is the SID, really. Maybe a blitter.
All right. Let's see. Earl, you have the next auction.
So this was interesting. It looks like it is and I'd never heard of this PS2 model. So did any of y'all use the PS2s, the microchannel architecture systems back in the day?
Yeah, we had a whole PS2 lab in high school that someone spent a whole lot of money on. It was very fancy and white.
Yeah, they weren't cheap computers, were they? And no. I worked in aerospace at the time that these came out, and we were Big Blue all the way. So we had tons of microchannel. I had them on my desk. I had to work on them. So I do have some nostalgia for these. But it looks like by the time this particular unit came out, I was out of the PS2 world, because this is a Model 77. I'd never heard of that. And it apparently is a 486-based PS2, which is also kind of fascinating. But microchannel architecture, it's got a 2.88 megabyte 3.5-inch drive, which is also fascinating. And the auction says that this is new in box, that it's never been used. The box is open, and that always makes me a little nervous, like, how do you know it's new in box? But right now, current listing is going for $1. So I guess you're not going to get ripped off at that price. And this, I just thought that this was fascinating, that occasionally a computer comes up on eBay that purports to be new in box and unused. And the other interesting thing about these PS2s is that, well, you know, you can still get a PS2 keyboard and mouse, because this class of machines basically invented the PS2 interface. And it's probably VGA, so you know you can get a modder that's going to hook up to it. So even though it doesn't seem to have those things, it probably wouldn't be too much trouble getting some peripherals to add to this to make a full working system. I don't know, actually, if you were in the market for a 486, why you would want to have a microchannel 486, because microchannel turned out in a lot of ways to be more trouble than it's worth. You need some sort of special setup disk for these machines to get them to recognize add-on cards. And, you know, they're just kind of like the EISA bus. If any of you ever worked with any of those machines, you know, there's some firmware and special drivers that you've got to have to make all that work. But still kind of cool. I'm fascinated to know what this is ultimately going to go for. But newly listed and currently going for $1 plus shipping.
It's a striking, it's a very bold, I mean, as far as the PS2s go, I like the look. IBM with their brutalist architecture on those things, it looks like something from, you know, the Empire. And
that is a good way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, and they have black versions, which look like they're actually taken from, the Death Star or something. But but yeah, I think, and you mentioned EISA, popular server bus with its higher bandwidth. That was, I believe, a response to microchannel, because I think IBM wanted, I think that they would license the bus as an option, but it was not free. I mean, it had a cost associated with it, and there were some drawbacks. So I think EISA was, the industry got together and created this alternate, better than ISA bus. I feel like I remember that was the case. Microchannel didn't really, even IBM moved away from it, before too long, I think.
It was like a last gasp to try to take back the industry that they lost with the clone makers, and it didn't work. People resented how open the XT and AT had been compared to the microchannel, which went completely the other way. And like you say, IP licensing costs and, patented and, the whole nine, trying to basically put people back in their ecosystem, it did not go over.
Yeah, I think, as you said, it had some complexity to it with the drivers. I mean, it was a much better bus than ISA, but yeah, it's, I think it was basically, I think the general feeling among, architecture nerds is that, it wasn't until PCI that, that was really an engineer's bus, as I've heard it described many, many times, as far as, being able to auto configure and, things like that. But yeah, and then of course, EISA, and then the local bus was kind of a cheap, quick hack for video cards. And yeah, it's interesting. I like reading about, I'm a kind of a architect, a bus, a motherboard bus buff. So I kind of dig that. But
well, and these machines were so easy to work on. I remember when our IBM rep first brought them in for us to, you didn't even need a tool set. You could modularly pop one of these things apart easily, do component level, board level or large component level repair on them quickly. And we had an IBM fellow come in and talk to us about the upsides of the microchannel architecture, the speed and performance and things like that. Sounded impressive, but wasn't somewhere the industry wanted to go. But there were lots of things to love, I guess is what I'm saying, about the microchannel systems. It's just that nobody loved the whole, give us back our ecosystem kind of approach from IBM.
I seem to recall that there was some, and it might have been the PS2 line, that someone brought it onto the Computer Chronicles and demonstrated like the way you could just like pull it apart into all these different little modules. And in fact, I think it actually didn't work very well. Like, something kind of went awry when the person was trying to demo it, but it was otherwise, it was still sort of a selling point.
I had to do it all the time. I could tell you it did actually work very well. So maybe they should have had a better demo model on the show.
The curse of live demos goes way back.
Yes.
Yeah, this is, I think, it. So attempting to bring all the little take all little pieces out, but they didn't quite come out according to plan. But it's
yeah, still he's having to stand up.
Yep,
get the leverage on that baby.
he's yanking on things pretty hard here.
Yeah, it just seemed like you might want to test this out a little ahead of time.
Yeah. Did something broke off of it there? What?
I think so.
This didn't crack. Hey, look over there.
This is sort of embarrassing.
Yeah. Computer Chronicles. I don't know. It's something from 1987.
I think we have to put this in the show notes because this is hilarious. Yeah, this poor guy. He's on live television trying to rip this computer apart with his bare hands.
It's the suit. It's too constricting.
I think that's got to be it.
No, I'm telling you, they worked much better than this. I can tell you that.
All right, but yeah, actually, the machine in the auction, getting back to that, is in amazing shape. Like even if it had once been used, it seems like all the pieces are still there.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, it's still got like the little foam taped keys on the front and everything. Yeah. Like if it's ever been powered on, they certainly barely touched it to do that.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Maybe I will move to mine. I mean, I'll just stick with one, I guess. This time, just because time is getting away from me. And actually, I'll do two very quickly. So this one, I thought this was interesting. This is the MCT Speed Demon. It's an Apple II accelerator. If you want to, the bidding starts at $650. You could buy it now for $900. Ouch.
Yikes.
Probably not worth it. Shipping is free. But what I kind of thought was interesting about this was largely just to see the box, because this was SSI, the whatever it is, strategic software something. You know, the people who made all the board games into
Strategic
computers.
Simulations Incorporated, I think.
Yeah. But they recommended this. Like this was sort of in the back of all their catalogs or even their manuals, you know, saying like, you know, if you want these to run at a reasonable speed, here's how you do it. So I found it just kind of neat just to see the box, you know. I don't think it's that neat to make it worth the money that they're charging, but it, you know, it's actually in pretty decent shape. You have many accelerator options for the Apple II, and this may not even be the best of them, but I just thought it was sort of interesting for that connection.
As a collector, this one might be interesting because it must be fairly rare, right? I've never heard of this one.
I certainly have never seen one. So I think it is rare in reality. The only reason I'd heard of it is because it's, you know, I keep scanning these SSI manuals and seeing it. But
I had heard of MCT. I remember the ad. They had some ads where I think that there's a big red apple on the front of the box for this eBay auction, but I think there was like a cartoon apple and it was wearing a kilt. And I think I read somewhere that like that MCT actually had started out as a Scottish computer manufacturer, peripheral manufacturer or something like that. I see the address is California on the mail-in card, but that just stuck in my head. I remember the ad with the apple in a kilt.
Strange.
Yeah. I think they made a few different devices, but that's got to be pretty early.
Yeah. Okay, and then the other one I was going to mention was this. This comes up, somehow it seems like we talk about this occasionally, more than I would have expected for how uncommon they are. But this is, I saw that there was a Multitech Microprocessor 2 on eBay. It is a buy it now of $790, or you can make an offer. It is just the unit, and it was taken in some kind of weird yellow light. So it looks like a lemon or something. But it looks like it is in reasonable shape for what it is. It's actually a very cheap computer. you know, it's not cheap to buy because it's super rare, but it's an Apple II almost compatible. So we talked about this a couple times. You know, it's based on the Apple II, except that the memory map is shifted around a little bit, and there's no text mode. It's all drawn in high res graphics, so it makes it a little bit not compatible. But there are sort of recipes you can follow to convert certain programs to make it work. So I don't know, and it's got a couple little flaws in the case. You know, something hot was resting against it at some point, and so it's a lot for just this thing. No box, no manuals, no anything.
It looks like it has a slot on the side.
Yeah, it has a single slot that you can put. Yeah, right. You can put, and it really is. It's an Apple slot just dangling off the side. But you can there's a disk drive. Controller you can put in there.
It's perhaps the least ergonomically well-designed computer I've ever encountered.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty goofy. This company also made whenever I look at this, it always reminds me of the modems that this company made. The Multitech modems look just like this, except they were a modem. So. Anyway, yeah, it's interesting. I think it's too expensive.
Do you have one?
There aren't very many of them. Oh. I do.
Okay.
Yes.
Silly question.
And I haven't played around with it as much as I want to, but the one I have actually has, I have the disk drive controller, and I have, there's an external keyboard as well. So you don't have to use this keyboard on top. It has the keyboard on this thing is just sort of like Chiclet keys in a little row on the front. But there is a place you can plug in a keyboard that sort of, you know, replicates all those things, but removable.
Interesting. So. I'd never heard of this one. I must not have been party to those earlier discussions.
Yeah, at some point I'll get it out and play with it. I brought it to Kansas Fest at one point and, you know, had it in the lounge, was, you know, working on trying to get it to do something, but I ran out of time and it went back in its box and it's still there. So anyway, okay, I'll leave mine at that. And then Quinn, you had something that's not exactly an eBay auction.
Yeah, I stuck it in here because it's sort of a find. It's in real life though, so maybe it's like an IRL Bay find. So I have another hobby, as many of you may know, of home shop machining. And one of my fellow home shop machinist fans emailed me the other day, and they said, hey, I've got this milling machine that I'm looking for a home for, and it was too heavy and too far away for me to go get. But the same person said, oh, also, you know about old computers, right? I also have this Apple III that I'm trying to get rid of. And that came out of the blue. So it was kind of a neat thing for me to talk about, just because it does turn out that people do still find interesting old computers in their attics who aren't necessarily in this hobby and don't necessarily know what it is. And there it is. So this one had apparently been stored in a, quote, moldy house for 15 years, but had apparently, he believes, never been used or used extremely little. And it does appear that to be the case. It's in really excellent shape. And this one was unexpectedly interesting. It had the disk 2 drive that's been converted to a disk 3, which is apparently unusual. And Paul, you said the serial number on it was low. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think it was like 14,000 something, 14,050 or something like that. And there was a recall of all the ones with a serial number under 14,000. So, I mean, this would have been like right after the recall.
Okay. Yeah. So kind of a neat random connection with someone. I was tempted by it. It's a really nice example of an Apple III. It does not have the monitor, unfortunately. The monitor he has for it is just some off-brand Sony, whatever, something, Sanyo something. It doesn't have the actual Apple III monitor. But yeah, we're currently in the process of finding a home for it, so it won't go to waste. But yeah, it's kind of neat that this random Apple III just appeared in my life. So here we are.
I wouldn't mind that happening in my life.
Yeah, like I say, I wish it was closer to me. It's he was hoping I could come and get it because he thought he might live close to me, but no, it would be a many, many days in the car for me to go get it, but we'll find a home for it.
It's nice. I actually have no more desk space. That's the main reason I've not added anything to my collection in probably 8 years. But I think I would actually make a space for an Apple III if one popped up.
Yeah, unfortunately, he says he's not able to ship it, so we're going to have to find someone local to him in the Seattle area for it.
Yeah, they are heavy, and the thing is that they're it's like a big heavy metal bottom case, made by someone who makes cars, I think, or something like that. I forget what the story is, but it's a very heavy machine. But then on top of it is a little plastic shell, not a good combination if you wanted to ship these things around.
Yeah, now it's a 40-year-old brittle plastic shell.
Yeah.
But if it didn't work before shipping, it's likely to work after, what with the 3-inch drop, right. I guess. Yeah,
exactly. It gets dropped 3 inches many, many times en route to you. So it's going to work super well.
Mail it around the world, right? Back to yourself.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I got a Lisa 2. Maybe I've said this before, but I got it from Vintage Micros. And this was, I think periodically goes through these times where he, he says, like, he's just getting rid of his inventory or whatever. And like, so he said, Nick, here's a, this is a Lisa 2 that doesn't work. You could buy a Lisa 2 from someone else for much more, which will eventually not work. Or you can buy this one, which already doesn't work right now. And so I said, all right, well, maybe I'll just, I'll just have this for display or something like that. But, he sent it to me and it worked when it arrived. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is something to that.
Yes.
Yeah. being banged around in shipping.
I followed the rule with when I bought my first Amiga 2000, when they were actually current, I mail ordered it and it came and it didn't work. So I lifted it up and remembered the drop 3 inches thing, and I did that, and then it worked from then on. So I guess it's not just the Apple III or the Lisa. Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Clock is ticking on here. So maybe we can move to closing discussions. Blake, do you have any closing thoughts?
Not so much vintage related. I guess I've been doing a lot of setup. I had an iMac that, 6-year-old iMac that was, starting to have some failures, so I've set up a Mac Studio, and I've been very busy putting all the tools and everything on it for work and play. So it's been interesting playing with a new, a new more powerful system, and so a lot of time with that, and I guess that's been the focus. So we'll continue on, and no complaints, no other things to offer.
Earl, any closing thoughts?
Well, just one. I did a RetroBits. Can I mention that here?
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yes. Can I say RetroBits on RCR?
Do I need to I guess I need to resubscribe. I didn't see it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was, I think Paul's posting was the most hilarious. He said the 2,877-day wait is over. And it really had been that long. It had been about 8 years since I did an episode. So it was fun. I started a little series on the, I didn't want to blab too much on RCR and take up all the time on the Altair stuff. So I'm doing a little series on that whole saga of recovering those and restoring and setting up. And the next one I'm going to talk about fixing up the disk drive unit, which actually isn't a MITS disk drive unit. It's this other ICOM branded disk drives that people sometimes paired with the Altair. And I was working with a gentleman in Texas who helped me get all that fixed up. And we actually not only got it fixed up, but got the ROMs archived. And he worked with somebody else to get it implemented in SimH. So now it's actually saved for posterity. You can emulate this hardware for the first time ever in the SimH simulator. So... So I'll talk about that on the next one. But yeah, it was fun to step behind the RetroBits mic, so to speak, and kick out another episode.
Nice. That's the first podcast I ever subscribed to. And it's the first retro computing podcast, obviously, that I ever listened to as well.
Yeah, me too. It's the first, in fact, I've often credited RetroBits for getting me back into this stuff and also for starting me down the road of building my own IPIC computer. So, yeah.
Cool.
Glad to see it back. And I've just resubscribed live on the air.
Yeah, I'll do the same.
And I never unsubscribed, so suddenly there was one in the feed. It's pretty great.
And your podcatcher said, nah, not really,
this,
right?
This can't be right.
Yes. All right, let's see. For me, I don't know, not a lot of work started again, and so like there has not been a lot of time. I'm actually, although I'm pretty behind in the editing, though someone was just saying that we got a feedback from somebody who's saying that, you know, like, that's a recurring thing. That's, you know, for the past 100 episodes or whatever, I've been saying, like, I'm pretty behind on the editing. But of course, for somebody who starts late and is just, like, listening to them all, that makes no sense. That's, you know, so anyway, I'm trying to catch up. I got a Turbo Mouse. Yes. Turbo Mouse.
Is that a little Kensington
trackball? It is. Oh, yeah. It is indeed.
Sweet. I've got one of those, too, for my 2GS.
Yep, so I'm exactly. Well, I specifically brought it back so that I could try out bugs. So, looking forward to that. Anyway, that's about it for me. Quinn, any closing thoughts?
No, just the same thing I always say, I guess, which is that I'm definitely very soon going to be setting up my retro computers here in the new office now that I have space for them, but it still has not happened. My 2C Plus is making sad eyes at me in a plastic bin in the closet right next to me here. And I'm now within driving distance of the mythical mom's basement full of Commodore and 2GS and 2 Plus stuff that someday soon I hope to go and get. So, but none of that has happened yet.
You'll have to share pictures when you get it set up.
For sure. Yeah, I'm going to need a new desk in here, I think. I don't really have enough desk space to do everything that I want to do. So, yeah, be some work there.
I actually bought a couple of tables. Like in my office, I have an L-shaped desk, and I was realizing, you know, I have to have these stacks of computers, and so I bought a couple of tables and put them on the desks, and so now I have, you know, like sort of mocked hutch there. So that actually works fairly well. I'm looking forward to actually setting up several computers there. All right, that was a long one. I think we probably could wrap this up. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
John, one of the things I think you do like about this machine is how quickly you can take it apart. It's kind of modular design. Can I ask you to sort of shut it down? And
yeah, we're going to see what...
Do that for me there.
It does turn off. I don't think they like this switch in the front, by the way, although some people think it's a good idea. It turns out that it will just allow people to accidentally turn it off easier. It takes this little 3.5-inch disc out. Most of the components of this machine... If you know what you're doing here, slide out, and things pop out. This is kind of interesting. You've got this.
You sure it pops out?
Yeah, they all pop out. It's just what's interesting about this particular. Let me get this little button here. You know. Oh, there it is. This is the tool that I didn't use to pop these things out. There's a little tool here, and you can pop out all these little rivets. There's a rivet here. Let me get this thing out of here. Well, anyway,
this really is a kind of a rector.
This
set
normally
approach.
A piece
I
of
can
cake.
See how easy this is.
Yeah,
out.
No, this is real simple to pop out here. We'll just pop this sucker out here. Well, let's see. Well, normally it just pops right out. It's very easy to do. I seem to be missing a couple of these little bolts down here that normally people don't think that these little bolts are going to last very long, but that's the only problem.
Those little plastic things that keep it all together.
Yeah.
I think you're getting closer.
Yeah, I am. I'm missing... Oh, there it is. Okay.
David, while he's messing around.
Oh, he's got it.
Yeah, got it. And then this hard disk like slides right out. You can pop a new one.
You got more bolts to pump in there. I think this is a problem.
This is really fun for people that like to take their computers apart and put it back together. I think it's a big ticker to it.